Welcome, Capital Raisers. We have RJ Brewer on the show today to talk about oil and gas syndications. It'd be really easy to spend multiple hours talking shop with him as he's very entertaining and has a wealth of information about this industry. Let's dive in and find out what makes this such a compelling argument for investors. So how are you guys doing? Are you guys ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships with me, talk shop about capital raising, or hire me as a coach, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show 262, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got RJ Brewer on the Capital Raiser Show. How are you doing, brother?
Man, I am doing terrific. How about you, Ruben?
Always excited, man. Always pumped up. Very excited to get going. You're a oil and gas indicator, so we'll chat a little bit about that. Quick shout out to Richard Wilson and Pitch Decks who power the show now. With that, let's get started, man. Tell us a little bit about your background. How'd you get into oil and gas indications?
Some kids get to grow up watching their dads practice medicine. Some get to watch their dads practice law. Oh. I got to watch my dad drill wells.
How about that? I didn't know that.
When we were kids, you had to go to work with dad day. My go to work with dad day, I was 7 years old. At that point, it was kind of mythic. I didn't really know what dad did. Hey, I was seven. He comes home. He says, okay, we're going to the field. And so we load up in the truck and we're driving out. And I don't know if many of y'all have been to Luling, Texas, but Luling, Texas has a smell. There's a smell to it. And it's oil. I mean, now hindsight being 2020, I know what it is, but it's the hydrocarbons that seep out of the ground and it smells like oil. Now, if you've ever actually smelled oil, it doesn't smell very good. It's not a very pleasant smell. And so we pull into Luling and the first thing I asked dad is, oh, dad, what's that smell? He looked at me and goes, baby, that's the smell of money. And so we keep on driving through. And all of a sudden we get out, you know, get out of the town. Now Luling's about the size of a hiccup and you get out of Luling and all of a sudden I see this big field and you see the pump jacks, or the iron horses that go up and down. And I see these pump jacks all over the field. And I said, dad, what are those? And he said, baby, every time one of those goes up and down, our partners are making money. And I've been hooked. I knew at that moment what I wanted to do. Got out of high school, earned my first partner within 3 weeks of graduation and haven't looked back. This is all I've ever done. My family, when I'm third generation, about to now, I've got some kids that are getting in their 20s now. And so we're about to turn to the fourth generation, but I'm not ready to turn the steering wheel over yet.
Fascinating. So you admired your father, or was it the business model? Like, my father was a medical doctor, colonel in the military, and also he was a mariachi player and he hung out with politicians. And he owned some real estate. So I wanted to be exactly like him when I was a kid. Did you have the same kind of sentiment for your dad?
Absolutely. That's basically it. You see what your dad doing. Now, if your dad's successful in something, most likely one of your kids is going to want to duplicate that. When you look at historically, there's a reason that companies that have second, third, fourth generation people running the company seem to be a step ahead of everybody else. I can only speak from my shoes. I know when I was 18 years old, I already knew more than most 30, 35-year-olds about the oil industry, and I was just a kid.
Yeah, that's all.
And so you start building on that knowledge, and you start seeing, as you get older, you start being able to interpret that data a little more efficiently. Then you see the trends, and you start understanding how the industry works and where the opportunities are.
So I got to ask this, because I study a little bit about generational wealth and legacy wealth and leaving an inheritance. And they say that the first generation makes some money, the second keeps it alive, and then the third generation a lot of times loses the money for a number of different reasons. But from your perspective, I think you said you're four generations strong. What do you think has kept us, or kept you guys, continuing to create more and more wealth in your family?
Well, that's understanding the industry. Because when you look at oil and gas, especially American oil and gas, that has been the biggest industry that has been misrepresented on what it truly is than anything I can think of. If you grab the average person walking down the street and said, name me an American oil company, they're going to go to Exxon. They're going to go to they're going to go to one of the large companies. While those companies might be based in America, they're really not American companies anymore. They're international. They're beholden to their shareholders. When you look at the majors, they're really not in America. 83% of your oil and 90% of your gas and 90% of the wells are drilled, operated, and produced by roughly 9,000 independent companies that average 12 employees or less.
So what percentage of the world's oil and gas? Because I've heard that we have more reserves than we're actually using, because I don't know, maybe we just want to save some for a rainy day. What percentage of the world's oil and gas is coming from America, from the United States?
That's kind of hard to determine right now, because a couple of years ago, we had more companies in operation. And so I wouldn't want to guess on an exact number and be an accurate, give people the wrong number. It's a large percentage. Now, what happened is, when you look at the oil industry in general, for the first roughly 60, 70 years of its existence, I kind of laugh. Everybody talks about their historical days and they come up with their theories. Well, I truly believe the modern world was born on August 27th, 1859. And that was the day that Edwin Drake placed the first commercial well in production in America. That introduced us to the hydrocarbon age. Well, the world's changed tenfold since that moment. What hydrocarbons have done for the world really can't even be measured. I was watching a show the other night, and they were talking about people that wanted to move away from hydrocarbons because they hated what it did. And he kind of paused. He said, "So you don't like the modern world?" Because that's what it's based on. There are 6,000 products created from one barrel of oil. From plastics to clothing, everybody in the modern world is in the oil and gas business, whether they want to be or not. We all pay it. When you look at the industry for the first 60, 70 years, it was basically controlled by the Seven Sisters. And they call them the Seven Sisters Oil. It was Exxon. Now, these are their modern names. Back in that day, they weren't called that, but this is what they evolved to. It was Exxon, Chevron, Texaco, Gulf, BP, Shell, and who was the last one?
Well, Chevron or Texaco or something?
Yeah, it was your major companies that you know today. And so what happened in 1960, OPEC was formed. And OPEC is really essentially Saudi Arabia. When you add OPEC plus, that's Saudi Arabia and Russia. And so OPEC was formed to counter the power of the Seven Sisters, because it's documented, looking back historically, they manipulated prices. They control what the price was. Sometimes they manipulate it for their own benefit. Sometimes they manipulate it for the U.S. benefit, but they controlled the prices. Well, when OPEC came in, they took some of that power. And all of a sudden, the Seven Sisters didn't control the price like they used to. Now, when it comes to American oil, that was a pivotal time also. Because thinking back on it, when you look at it, back in the 30s, these companies had been drilling American oil for 50 years. Now, at that point in time, they were using antiquated technology. And their view of how much oil was in the United States was a little, let's just say premature. They started getting nervous because they'd go out, they'd find a field, then they'd find another field. Well, they'd leave the first field, go to the second, and they'd bounce around from field to field, knowing they didn't fully develop those fields, but there were so many fields that they were finding that they just leapfrog from field to field. Well, all of a sudden they get to the point where they start looking and they think, wow, we've discovered all the big fields in America. What are we going to do for the next 15, 20 years? They started getting nervous. Well, that all changed in the mid 30s when they found oil in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And then in 1958, they found the Ghawar field, which was the largest conventional oil field on the planet, 80 billion barrels of oil. And then it was cemented in the mid 50s when they found oil in Nigeria and Algeria. So at that point in time, all of these large companies started turning their eyes overseas and started leaving American production in the rearview mirror. Well, the evolution of that 70 years later is the current state of the American oil industry. Roughly 9,000 independent companies that average 12 employees or less. Now, the proof of that, just look at, and don't take my word for it, get on the internet and type in largest oil companies in the world. The very first list that will come up is a list of the current major oil and gas companies. Now, your major oil and gas companies are defined as having a market cap of 10 billion or more. Well, worldwide, there are only 75 companies that would be considered major oil and gas companies. Of those 75 companies, only four of them produce their oil strictly in the United States. Of those four, only one of them was created in the last 30 years. And so what you have, now I'm not saying they're not great producers. There's some tremendous producers in America. There are some of these independent companies that are very well run and they do a tremendous job. However, when you look at the landscape of oil, I had a partner ask me the other day, and he said, this has been the state of the oil industry in America for the last 70 years. Why is now the time to get heavy in oil? And I said, it's easy. April 20th, 2020, when those prices crashed, it wiped out a large percentage of those independent companies. It cleared the playing field. Now the companies that remain, while like I said, some of them are tremendous companies, but they're companies just like ours. We don't see any David and Goliath matchups in our horizon. The question is, can we beat them? Are we good enough with what we do that we can win a fair fight with a company that has a limited budget? You see what we're seeing. Because right now, when those prices crashed, now you have buying opportunities left and right in America. And that's what we see the opportunity for a company to come in and start consolidating all of these fields and putting them under one roof. Because honestly, if I learned anything over the last 2 years, it's this. If a country does not control its food, its medicine, or its energy, it's in trouble. Right now in America, we don't control any of them. Well, I can't do anything about the first two, but by God, I can do something about the third. And if we can get enough momentum going, all of a sudden we look up 20 years from now and you have a group like ours that controls 300, 400, 500 million barrels. Because the whole key is we're not getting off of oil. Doesn't matter how much we want it. Doesn't matter how much I believe all of us have a little green energy, you know, little environmentalist in us. I love a pristine environment. I love clean streets. I mean, I'm just like everybody else. But what we want and desire doesn't change what is. And what is there is nothing right now that can economically and effectively replace oil. Now, they can tell you that. They can say, I mean, think of solar panel. You hear a lot of people say, hey, solar panel is the way of the future. Man, they discovered the first solar panel in the mid-1800s. They've been researching solar panels for almost 200 years. You mean to tell me they hadn't figured it out yet? And all of a sudden, they're going to produce the amount of electricity the United States uses annually. It would take a solar farm using the most modern solar panels on the planet. It would take a solar farm the size of New Jersey, and it would require the sun to shine 24 hours a day, 365 days a year at Arizona summertime intensity.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too crazy. Let's definitely jump into the business model. There's a lot of people, a lot of my audience, they're into commercial real estate syndication, but I see more and more movement from my industry into energy. So let's kind of explain a little bit about the industry in terms of how you guys run your business. You particularly, are you investing and raising money for the wells, for the oil rights, for the mineral rights, for the land, the real estate? What part of it makes the most money? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the tax benefits. Tell us a little bit about your business model.
Well, historically, your most money is made in drilling wells. But in the same breath, your biggest risk is drilling wells. It is a risky business. If anybody ever calls you and tells you they have a guarantee in oil and gas, they're lying to you. There are no guarantees. Only the good Lord above knows exactly what's down there when you start drilling. You can get all the data, you can get all the geology, you can get all the seismic. You can get everything in your pile that you want, but until you actually drill that well, you don't know. What we try to do, historically, our partners have participated through the actual drilling of wells. We'll say, put together a drilling program, a 506C program, where say we'll put five wells in the program. Of those five wells, four of those wells will be safety net wells. Wells that's offsetting production, maybe re-entering a well we had drilled in the past. You know, something where you've lowered the risk, where your chance of finding production on those wells are much greater than the fifth well. Now, those four wells right there, their sole purpose is capital preservation. Their sole purpose is to produce enough money that worst case scenario, if we miss the big well, those four wells will get your money back, maybe make you a little money on top and you'll be happy, no harm, no foul. However, if we hit that wildcat well, that fifth one, all of a sudden you're looking at 10, potentially 15 to one on your money, 20, depending on prices. It just depends on what the reserve report is. Each well is a little different. And so traditionally, that's how you structure programs. Where we're a little different and what we have done, this is nothing academic. This is nothing you can go to a college and see this theory. But after 30 years, we've built theories on the industry from experience. From my perspective, here's how the oil and gas industry works. Those 9,000 independent companies, every one of them started out roughly the same. They started out with a group of guys that had a dream. They wanted to drill a well. So they go out and they raise some money. They go out and they drill the well. Well, for 99.9% of your oil companies, that's the end. They miss the well. They can't raise any more money. All of a sudden, a close for business sign goes in front of their door. Well, every now and then, one of those companies hit that well. Well, when they hit that well, they've created what we call job security. Their job is secure for as long as they have wells to drill around that first well and develop that field. That's what they'll do. That's how they found that job security. Well, while they're developing that field, they'll drill wells in other spots, hoping to find another one. Now, once again, the companies that make it to that second stage, that's where 99% of them die. They can never find that second field. And so they're done. Well, the fortunate few that do find the second field, now they have a lily pad. When they get done developing this field, boom, they'll move to the next field. A successful oil man looks up, he's 70 years old, 75 years old. He's discovered 5, 10, 15 of these fields. Here's the big difference. most of your oil and gas, and I'm saying the largest percentage of your independent companies, they spend their entire career doing what we call chasing oil, meaning every one of those fields that they find, they have to produce every bit of oil out of that field to keep the engine running. And so they lily pad from here to here to here. They look up 40 years later, they've discovered 5, 10, 15 fields. Their partners have made great money. They made great money. However, they had to produce everything they found. So they spent their whole career chasing oil. The next evolution, every now and then a company gets to the point where they jump out of that chasing oil bucket. And what I mean is they get to the producing oil stage. In the producing oil stage, it doesn't mean you're going to hit every well you drill. Once again, this is oil and gas. You're going to miss some wells just by the nature of the industry. But what it does mean is every time you drill a well, you know the oil's there. More importantly, you have enough reserves in-house that you can utilize those reserves to acquire more reserves. To make that leap is probably the rarest leap an oil and gas company makes, getting to the producing oil stage. Because at that point, typically one of three things happens. Either one, a major comes in and buys you out. Two, you love the revenue, your partners love the revenue, you keep everything private and keep doing what you're doing. Or three, you take it public. That's when you get to that producing stage. That's pretty much your options. Now, you have the fourth option. They start missing wells and they go belly up. That does happen as well. But typically, once you get to that point, that options percentages go way down. To do that, like I said, is the rarest thing. When you look at me and my family, and it does sound like bragging, and I'm not a braggart. I don't want to stand out and brag. However, when people are looking at us and deciding whether they want to hitch their wagon to ours, to know that my family not only did it once, but now we've done it twice. That's where we're sitting right now, as we've moved into that producing oil stage. And what we do as a company, we acquire fields. We go out, and with everything that has happened over the last couple of years, you have a playing field that has been wide open. Take that same successful oil man that we were talking about a second ago. He's 70, 75 years old. Remember, back on April 20th, when prices crashed, it had several major effects. Right off the bat, it wiped out the companies that were not financially solvent. The companies that, honestly, not to be mean, but they shouldn't have been here anyway, all of a sudden they were gone. Well, the next wave of companies that went down were your companies that, remember what happened right after that? COVID went in full effect and we sent everybody home.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden we were paying people to stay at home more than they were making coming back to work. And so your larger corporations, your larger independent companies, they could pay their people more and get them back out. Your smaller companies that couldn't pay their people more, they lost their companies because they couldn't get people back out in the field to work. Well, that was your second wave that went down. You look at that 75-year-old man. Him and his wife have been working on this field for 15 years. They have a couple of million in the bank. All of a sudden, Corona hits and all their workers go home. So now here they're sitting there and they're trying to determine where they're going next. Paul looks at Ma and says, Ma, here's what we can do. We got a couple of million in the bank. We can take that money. We can rehire our people, get them back to our field. We can get working again. And hopefully in a couple of years, we're back to where we are right now. Or we can wipe our hands of it and walk away and retire.
Interesting. Okay, this has been very insightful. We got to cover a couple of things here before we go into the lightning round, though. My first question, I've heard that you can strike out like 9 out of 10 wells that you invest in, but if you hit the 10th well, you can like 100x your money. So is this a fair statement or is this completely nonsensical? There's a lot of stuff that we hear as non-oil and gas investors. Trying to get some clarification here. If I had $250,000 and I wanted to invest with you, how would you sell me or what would I be investing in? Would it be the actual rigs that pump the oil or the fields or what would I be investing in exactly?
It depends on what your goals were and what we had to offer at that point in time. If you came to me at any typical time, I would have a drilling program to put it in. What you would be basically buying is the minerals, the mineral rights. That's what we've acquired with the landowners, and we go into contract negotiations and we secure the mineral rights. Well, what the partners do, they put their money in to drill the wells. And for that, they get a tremendous tax benefit. You don't do it for tax benefits, but to not mention the tax benefits is you're leaving an arrow in the quiver. But when you're looking at it, now, once again, I'm not a CPA. I can just give you a typical rule of thumb.
Yeah.
For every 100,000 you invest, Uncle Sam's going to basically pay for a third. And so it's an above line deduction. Basically, let's say you make $500,000 in a year and Uncle Sam says, okay, you owe us $150,000 in taxes. All of a sudden, if you put, let's just say $500,000 in oil, you basically, now you don't owe Uncle Sam anything. you're going to have about $150,000 in tax benefits. Mm-hmm. And it's dollar for dollar. If you have passive income and it's passive income, you can invest as a passive investor. You can be a general partner or a limited partner. So your tax benefits would go against passive income. But as a general partner, your tax benefits go against your active ordinary income, what you make in a day-to-day living. And so that's one of the benefits. So going in, you know, you're playing on roughly 60, 65 cent dollars. What do these wells do? I'll put it to you this way. The best and worst oil and gas program I ever put together all happened within the same field. I'm 24 at this point in time. As a company, we had just raised the largest raise we've ever had, $4.5 million at that point in time. And so we go out and we're drilling the biggest well we've ever drilled. It had 6,000 foot vertical and 6,000 foot horizontal legs, 12,000 foot total measure. We go out and raise the money and we drill the well and did not hit enough oil or gas to change up your car. Absolutely nothing. And so at 24, you know, we do a heck, I learned early. It is what it is. If it's black, it's black. If it's white, it's white. There is no gray. And so like a good little soldier, we picked up the phone. We called every one of the partners, said spot died, other than your tax benefits. We've lost everything. We get through the partner base. We tell everybody, yeah, I mean, everybody was upset, but we're right up front. I mean, you're in oil and gas. You're going to miss some months. So here about a week and a half later, we get a call from our partner, Mr. Bridges. Mr. Bridges, we put up half the money. He put up half the money. Mr. Bridges calls and says, hey, guys, I just want to let you know Marathon Oil just bought my 50% out. And so I remember sitting in my dad's office. This was back before he retired. And at that point, I really was too young to have an opinion. And so I was just kind of a fly on the wall listening to him. And I remember him looking at me and said, hang on. We just drilled a $4.5 million dry hole and Marathon Oil just bought out our 50% partner. Well, they know something that we don't know. And so when Marathon called us to buy our 50% out, we wouldn't sell. And we said, no, here's what we'll do. We'll put up our money. You put up your money. You go drill it. Go be Marathon. Go do what you do. We'll just put up half the money. And so that's what we did. So we immediately turned around and had to call every one of those partners that we had just lost $4.5 million. Now, it turned out to be about $4 million after tax benefits, but we had to call these guys, tell them the story, say, hey, here's what happened. I've got to offer it to you before I offer it to anybody else. Well, thank goodness, every partner but one bought their position again. We came down, when we drilled the well, we went 6,000 in this way. When Marathon drilled it, they went 6,000 in this way. This well right here came on producing right at 7 million cubic feet of gas a day. Paid the first $4.5 million off in 9 months, paid the second $4.5 million off in 18 months. And we ended up drilling another 8 wells, basically just like that with Marathon over the next couple of years. And then when I say we made it to the producing oil stage once, well, at that point in time, that's where we were. And then Marathon came out and they wanted to take those wells from 6,000 feet to about 18,000 feet. And so now at this point, I'm a little older. I'm probably 28, 29 at this point. And I started running the numbers and I looked at my dad and said, Dad, do you realize what the numbers they're projecting? It's going to take our partners 20 years to get their money back. We can't do this. And so we told Marathon, no, we can't do it. Now, what they were doing, they weren't drilling it for the daily production. They were drilling it for the reserves. Because once you can book those reserves now, whether you have them out of the ground or not, they go on your balance sheets. And so that's what Marathon was doing. And so when we said no, that would have stopped them from doing it. At that point, they came in, and I laugh, I kind of call it, they godfathered us. They came in and made us an offer we couldn't refuse, and they bought the entire company. That was the end of my first life in oil. That was about 14, 15 years ago.
That's a cool story.
And so we retired for a couple of years, and here about 7 years ago, me and my dad and my brother were sitting there, and I looked at him and I said, guys, I'm going stir crazy, that I love oil, I love making money, I love making my partners money, and I'm tired of chasing a golf ball around. And so that was when we sat down and we started Panax.
That's cool.
And from that day to today, right now, we've acquired enough reserves. We're sitting on what could be more than 100 million barrels of oil that we have to develop over the next handful of years. And so it's just, it's a labor of love. Don't get me wrong. I am the most capitalistic. I want to make more money than you can spend. But in the same breath, when you love what you're doing, and really when you see the environment in which we're doing it, man, I'm providing my partner something, like I said earlier, we're all in the oil business. We're all paying the price. Well, if I'm that one little sliver of hope that can protect some of my partner's money from that energy price that they're paying, they're lining up 6 days a week and twice on Sunday to get involved. Because the key is finding a market in which the right time to buy it is now. Look at real estate. I love real estate. But a lot of my partners are real estate guys.
Yeah.
Well, price is right now. If you sell something, what else are you going to buy that will grow up? And so they're kind of at a, they don't know what to do. And here about 2 years ago, it was about 3 a.m. I mean, it hit. You remember when the silver crunch happened and everybody, they were making the run on silver? And
I don't follow the precious metals. Let me ask you about the capital raising.
Okay.
I want to cover this real quick before we jump into the lightning round, because we got about 12 minutes left before we got to shut it down. Tell me, what did you used to do to raise capital and how's that evolved over time?
I did exactly what you think I did. I was actually talking with the girls this morning. I said, do y'all realize the most dials I made in one day was almost 1,500 dials?
Wow.
That's what we used to do. We'd get phone lists and we would smile and dial. Look, that's what most people don't really realize when it comes to what we're doing right now, because most of your oil companies were formed in the last 20 years. And so they really don't know the true oil industry. Well, man, I cut my teeth in oil when we were going through the roughest stage or the end of the J.R. Ewing era of oil. That's when I learned. I remember selling when oil was $8 a barrel. Well, the last 20 years, it's averaged $6 a barrel. So when I put a program together, my mind goes to $20 a barrel. I'll run the numbers at 20, and I'm not saying that's what we want, but I'll run the numbers at 20. And if we can live with what those numbers are at 20, well, man, we're going to be tickled when numbers are 60, 70, 80, $100 a barrel. So all of a sudden, none of these guys really understand what we're doing and what we're about to accomplish. So now I look at the industry, and really when it comes to raising money, the big evolution, it's easy. It was a cell phone. The minute call waiting came in and the minute consumers had the chance to look at their phone and see who was calling them, the cold calling game ended. Now, don't get me wrong, you can still do it, but it's so much more ineffective now. Back in the day, I knew every 100 dials I made, I generated one lead. Every 10 leads I generated, I would make 2 sales. That was the numbers. So how many sales do I want to make? Well, if I need $100 for one lead, I need 5 leads to make 1 sale. So I got to make $500 dials to make 1 sale. I knew my batting average. Well, now the world's not the same. Now you can't say that I make $100 and generate 1 lead. And so how do you generate your leads now? Just like this. You go face to face, because this is something when a partner invests, there are 3 factors. Doesn't matter what industry, doesn't matter who you are. There are 3 factors that have to be positive every time or they won't invest. The first is their responsibility. The other 2 are yours. The factor that is theirs is the money. I can't tell you how much you have and I can't tell you how much you can invest. Our programs are accredited for accredited investors. So you have to have the financial wherewithal to handle the investment. Yeah. Now, if that box is checked and you are, I set it aside and don't worry about it again. Now it's on me and my 2 factors. First, who are we? Jay Burr, Panex. Why are we the kind of people, the Burr family? Why are we the kind of people that you want to hitch your wagon to? If you don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling talking to me, don't do it. There are millions of places in the world you can put your money. Well, once you see that we're the kind of people you'd like to do business with, now it boils down to what are we doing? Economically, like I said, there are millions of places in the world you can put your money. Yeah. Why is what we're doing something you need to look at?
Yeah, that's something that you're going to want to explain for sure. Tell me, how do you work with co-GPs? How does that work?
Typically, there's a syndication agreement. We look for what they're aiming for, what amount they can raise, what kind of returns they're anticipating, and what we can put them in. It's just really if they have partners that need tax benefits and they want to drill wells and they want to put money direct in direct participation programs, we'll get with them and set up the syndications where they can do it that route. Cool. If they want to try something else, it's their partners. We don't, you know, I'm a salesman at heart. I know if you ask me for my list of clients, you'd have a better shot of me stopping a bullet with my hand than me giving it to you, because it just, my partners are sacred to me. And so we know with syndicators, we're not looking at jumping into your partner base. They're your partners. You've earned them. There's a reason they're with you. However, if you see that we're the kind of guys that your partners want to get involved in, we'll figure out a way to put something together where it benefits you and your partners, or we won't do it.
Yeah, I can imagine that there's a few people in the audience that'd be interested in kind of moving into something else different than real estate. So wouldn't be surprised if they reach out to you. Let's jump into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Literally this past Christmas, I convinced my wife and kids. See, I lived in Lake Tahoe for about 5 years there. And back when I was a kid, not to toot my own horn, I got to become a pretty good skier. None of my kids, I've been in Kentucky for the last 30 years. And so none of my kids are not much skiing in Kentucky. So we had never gone skiing, never went out of town, never did. We always went to beaches. And I convinced my wife and kids that this Christmas, before Christmas, we went to Breckenridge.
Nice.
And I'll tell you what, I remember I had one of those revelation moments. My wife and I, we love driving. So one day we get in the car, we're driving through the mountains. And I remember getting to this one little lookout where I pull over. Yeah, I did the tourist thing, got my camera out. I mean, I'm standing in snowdrifts waist high, taking pictures of trees. I look around the horizon and you see three big mountains all meeting and creating this valley. And I looked at it and I said, man, we don't know what work is. Yes, I do work technically, but I sit at the desk and talk to people on the phone. The people that cut that trail, that's true work. Then you just look at the awesome power of all that. Yeah. And it brought up, it really made me had an epiphany on climate change.
Favorite book of any kind?
Think and Grow Rich and Atlas Shrugged.
Do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
Be honest.
Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
The day my first son was born, my oldest child.
Awesome. All right, so short answer on this, best way to raise capital from your perspective?
Work harder than anybody else and do what you say you're going to do.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay, cool. How about this? What do you love best about being a sports dad?
Watching them, watching the light bulb go off, and not just my kids, on any kid. When you see a kid, they finally understand it. Man, that's awesome. It really is. Just to see their little eyes light up.
And you said some of your kids won championships. Is that right?
My oldest was a two-time state champion in Kentucky in jiu-jitsu and a two-time state champion in Tennessee. My middle son went to the Little League World Series. They were the first team from Bowling Green, Kentucky to make it to the Little League World Series in Williamsport. Awesome. My 16-year-old daughter was just named the Region 4 in Kentucky Soccer Player of the Year as a sophomore after scoring 58 goals.
Wow.
And my seventh grader just got invited by the Kentucky Education Board to be one of the handful of students that pre-take the ACT in seventh grade, where they make sure they have her in the advanced classes when she gets to high school.
Congrats.
And so, no, proud dad. I'm one of those guys. I'm fortunate. It didn't come from me. I mean, you know, man, my wife sure does have some good genes.
Very good. All right. Let me ask you this one. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Yes. I believe that the golden rule, if we could eliminate all laws, and if everybody just followed the golden rule, the world would be a much better place.
Agreed. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Yes and no. That's a long story, but yes, they change.
What impact would you like to leave in the world?
When I'm gone, I just want them to say, hey, he did it right. He worked hard. And when he was gone, others' people's lives were better because of
him. Fantastic answers on the lightning round. Thanks for entertaining us on that part of the show. I love that part of the show.
Oh, no worries.
Shout out to the Capital Razor Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to Legacy Acquisitions, my company, and our sponsors, Syndication Pro up in the Family Office Club. Oh, and Pitch Decks, of course. Check out their offers at capitalrazorshow.com. RJ, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
Panex.us/learn. That's the best place you can go. You can download Oil and Gas 101. It's a primer on oil and gas. Just fill you in on the industry. Oil and Gas 102 is the tax side of it. And then reach out to us. I'm not going to twist your arm. I'm not going to yank your hair. It is what it is. That's kind of our philosophy. We're going to tell you what it is. And if you choose to be a part of it, hey, welcome aboard. If not, I've been told no before. You're not going to hurt my feelings.
That's cool. All right. So if somebody wants to potentially partner with you, or for anybody that wants to move away from different asset classes and get into oil and gas, what are your parting words of wisdom for people raising capital and moving into the oil and gas space?
Meet them face to face, shake their hand, and get a good feel for them. The first thing you have to be confident in is the people. Like I said, if you don't get that warm, fuzzy feeling about the people, it's an uphill climb from that point on.
Fantastic, man. So this is really good, man. Hopefully we can have you back and we can chat it up a little bit more. There's, I think, a lot more to cover here. People are curious about energy, oil, and gas. So I don't think we got quite through as much information as people are really seeking. But this has been a blast, man. Thanks for hanging out with us on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no worries, Ruben. If you ever need anything, I'm right here. Just let me know. Have gun, will travel.
Heck yeah. All right, man. With that, we'll let you go. Thank you.